Hold on.
We are broadcasting.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. And we have two items on the agenda today, an informational meeting and a public hearing. And we will start with an informational meeting on the American Rescue Plan Act.
Or a roll call, Madam Chair.
Oh, I did it again. First of all, we'll call the roll.
Senator Findley?
Senator Findley, present by audio in a snowstorm.
Senator Riley?
Present by video.
Senator Wagner?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Present by audio. Sounds like the vapor chamber out there.
Madam Chair Burdick?
Present by video. I guess the echo's gone now, so whatever happened has been fixed. Okay, now we will open an informational meeting on the American Rescue Plan Act. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the item we have here is a presentation that we gave to House Revenue last week, and it's basically a one-pager of where we are on the revenue impacts related to the ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act. So Kyle is going to walk through that. You do also have in the room, in case there are questions, the Department of Revenue. Marjorie and Ben Gilly are here, and Kate Toswell is also in the room in case you have questions for Ledge Council. But otherwise, Kyle is prepared to walk through our high-level view of where we understand the potential revenue acts to be at the moment.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And there is a document in OLUS that I'll be referencing. I'll get my screen shared here in just a moment, but it's related to the American Rescue Plan Act, or the ARPA, which is the most recent COVID relief bill that was just passed at the federal level. So kind of the intent today is just to walk through some of these provisions as they relate to the revenue implications at the federal level and here in Oregon, and to step through those effects that are both direct effects that we see that come right into Oregon automatically through our connection to federal tax law, and then some of the indirect effects that work their way through the federal tax subtraction that we have here in Oregon. But with that, I'll go ahead and share my screen with what you have up in OLUS as well for those that are following along. Okay, so let me see if I can get this sized correctly here. This is the American Rescue Plan Act. This is a federal tax change that happened just a couple weeks ago. The larger package itself was about $1.9 trillion. That's in federal dollars. It did have changes later, tax policy changes, that would reduce revenues on net by about $590 billion over 10 years at the federal level. So again, here in Oregon, what I plan to just walk through today is just some of these revenue implications for Oregon from these federal changes. So the first such change, and this is what we'd consider a direct effect. So this is related to this effect at the federal level automatically comes into Oregon through our federal connection. And this one, in this case, will be related to the rolling reconnect. And it has to do with the unemployment insurance income exemption. So because that's related to the definition of taxable income, Oregon is automatically connected to this right away as of the federal tax change. And what the change is at the federal level, it then becomes Oregon policy as well, is an exemption of up to $10,200 in unemployment income if the taxpayer's adjusted gross income is less than $150,000. Now, this is effective for tax year 2020. So this is actually related to last year. And it relates to the tax returns that people are filing right now today, or have already begun filing, or will continue to be filing in this tax filing season. So this spring, and then some of the extension filers as well. But so this is an exemption, which means it is up to $10,200 in income that is not subject to taxation. And this $10,200 in unemployment income relates to the individual on the tax return. So for a single filer, that means the first $10,200 in unemployment income is not subject to taxation, so long as their AGI is less than $150,000. If it's a joint filer, this $10,200 exemption applies to both of the individuals. So that means if you have two individuals, a joint filing return, each of those individuals, if they received unemployment income, can have up to $10,200 in that income exempt from taxation. But it is pointed to the individual. So if you had one taxpayer on the joint return, say had $15,000 in unemployment income, and the other taxpayer, the spouse, had zero, that exemption is $10,200 because it relates to the single individual's unemployment income. So it can be combined for a joint filer up to $20,400 if they both have unemployment income, but it does, the exemption is specific to the individual. So you could have two individuals, but it doesn't sum for a joint return automatically. It has to go to the specific individual receiving that unemployment income. The preliminary revenue impact that we have on this one is about, we're thinking would be a revenue loss about $200, maybe up to $250 million. And again, this is related to the unemployment income from tax year 2020, which is being filed right now and returns today. So that we'd expect most of this revenue impact could occur in this fiscal year, but some of it could also, we could see in fiscal year 21, 22 as well from some of those extension filers and such. One thing of note here is in partially in response to this provision, the IRS changed the return, or they're in the process of changing the return filing deadline, and Oregon would align with that. And there is some information, there's a two-pager in OLIS from Department of Revenue that explains some of that information and how Oregon kind of connects to that filing date. But again, this is important because this is unemployment income that is being reported on returns right now today, or has already, for people that have already filed, they may have filed without this exemption because it just became law. And so how to handle those returns that may no longer are in need of possibly having this exemption, kind of correcting the amount, if you will, on the return. So it's like, how does that work forward? That's a process that's still underway. We're receiving guidance at the IRS level. Here in Oregon, how to interact with that as well. Again, there's information from Department of Revenue and OLIS, but again, this is kind of an ongoing process that's happening right now today, and that does in part reflective of one month extension of the tax return deadline. So instead of being April 15th, we're looking at a May 17th deadline. But that's related to the unemployment income. The second direct effect that I would draw your attention to has to do with the earned income tax credit. So this is a federal change. And again, Oregon is connected to the federal earned income tax credit, in that Oregon's earned income tax credit is 9 or 12% of the federal credit. So the change at the federal level in this case is related to tax year 2021. So that's for this year that we're in right now and would affect returns that we would see coming in next spring, so a year from now. But because there were changes at the federal level, and many of these changes relate to childless taxpayers, but because there were changes at the federal level expanding the amount of this, the earned income tax credit at the federal level, Oregon's percentage of that becomes greater. So we would expect Oregon's earned income tax credit to also expand in a revenue impacts sense, and also from a policy sense, predominantly for these bullets you see here, childless taxpayers, the credit amount, age parameters and such. One other change is using your 2019 income in place of your, what would be your 2021 income, if it gives you a larger earned income tax credit. So again, all these changes are now, in this case, could potentially affect Oregon's earned income tax credit. And a key distinction here between here and the unemployment exemption is the earned income tax credit. This would be a direct effect here in Oregon, but it does require Oregon's point in time connection change. So this isn't related to our definition of taxable income. This has to do with Oregon's point in time connection change, which is that standard bill that the committee sees each year related to a date at which point Oregon connects. And that connection date has to be in the past, but a date at which Oregon selects to connect to the federal tax law as of that date. So traditionally, this is a December 31st. It would be a December 31st, say 2020 year date. In this case, the committee, if the committee would like to adopt these earned income tax credit changes, we'd be looking at a date change here in Oregon in that annual legislation. That date change would have to be post the ARPA change at the federal level. So to capture this earned income tax change, we need a date later, sometime here in March, would capture those changes, and then they become part of Oregon's tax policy for the earned income tax credit. Again, a preliminary revenue impact of the change here is about negative $13 million. Again, this is related to tax year 2021, so we wouldn't expect to see much of this effect until next year, about a year from now, when tax returns begin coming in for tax year 2021. So in terms of indirect effects, these are generally considered these indirect in that they work their way through the tax system through Oregon's federal tax subtraction. So just briefly, Oregon has a federal tax subtraction. It is means tested. There are certain qualifications to it, but the general idea is taxpayers that pay federal tax can deduct part of that federal tax here in Oregon from their Oregon income when they file their Oregon taxes. So a tax change at the federal level can then work its way through kind of indirectly into an individual's Oregon tax liability. So if there's something that reduces tax liability at the federal level, from an Oregon tax return perspective, that could increase that taxpayer's income subject to Oregon taxation. So a tax cut at the federal level could lead to a potential tax increase, if you will, for that taxpayer here in Oregon, in that they have less federal tax to subtract from their income when they file their Oregon taxes. I'll just briefly hit on kind of four indirect effects we have here, but in terms of an overall impact, we are looking at kind of a positive here on the revenue side of about $155 to $170 million. Again, this is through the federal tax subtraction, so we would see the timing of this, we think, would be mostly in the 21-23 biennium as it's related to the 2021 tax returns. So this is something that we'd expect to, you'd see the positive revenue flow, if you will, from this, most likely beginning next spring. So where the unemployment exemption would be affecting revenue today, as people are filing their taxes, these indirect effects, these positive effects, will be offsetting some of that revenue loss, but it will be occurring most likely in a different biennium. It'll be occurring next year. But again, these indirect effects, the largest of these is the recovery rebate credits. They're also known as the economic impact payments. And these are the round three payments that started going out at the federal level just, I think, in the last week or two. People have started to see these deposits in their bank accounts where they're getting essentially a $1,400 per individual refundable credit at the federal level that are coming out in advance. So they're kind of these advanced credits that are being paid to individuals through those checks or those direct deposits that are hitting bank accounts. The other changes I would just highlight is there was change at the federal level, related to the federal child tax credit. This is a one-year change, tax year 2021, expanding that federal child tax credit. Again, by doing that, that can reduce tax liability at the federal level, which can feed in here in Oregon in a positive sense, in terms of more income then for the person when they're filing their Oregon tax return. There were changes to the federal child dependent care tax credit, and then also the federal unemployment exemption. By exempting that unemployment benefits at the federal level, it could potentially reduce someone's tax liability at the federal level, which then filters through again to that federal tax subtraction being less, potentially increasing their taxable income here in Oregon when they file. But so those are kind of offsetting effects, offsetting indirect effects to those direct changes, the earned income tax credit and the unemployment insurance income. Just number three here, there are some other provisions here as well, smaller in scope, things we're kind of keeping track of, and we'll have more information on those later, but just wanted to highlight some of those other provisions that are in the ARPA that do feed through here into Oregon for various reasons. And then the last provision, this one is definitely getting some discussion, is related to state and local aid. So also included in the ARPA was a provision more or less trying to offset or keep a state government that's receiving some of these ARPA funds from offsetting those funds through a tax cut at the state level. So this is still very early in the language. The language is in the bill, but there's still more information that'll be coming out from the IRS and the Treasury level to better understand what does this mean for states. But the general concept here was if you receive this federal money, these federal funds coming to states or local governments, it would then attempt to offset those funds. If you receive those funds and the state then more or less uses those funds to cut a state income tax, say, for example, then they would, the federal government basically ask for those funds back in line with how much that tax cut was. And the general idea, I think the policy idea here was the federal government trying to limit these flow of funds from the federal government then being used to just more or less reduce state tax revenue. So just flowing those straight through to a tax cut is the general idea. Again, there's a lot of nuance there. This is initial information that's coming out, and I believe we have legislative counsel here as well if you'd like to have questions more specifically related to this provision. But with that, that's a general high-level overview. of the ARPA, and happy to try to address any questions if you have them.
Thank you. I have a question from Senator Boquist, but before I ask him to give his question, could you, have we gotten reassurance that the connection that we have to the unemployment tax relief is not going to throw us into the offset provision that you mentioned last? We've got an echo going here. Did you hear me?
I think that's a question, Madam Chair. I think that's a question for Kate Toswell.
Oh, okay. It's Kate. Yeah. What's causing this echo, Chris? You know?
In the past, it's been somebody who has had two devices open and not on mute.
Okay. Can anyone with... It's gone now, so they must have fixed it. So Kate, would you address that, and then we'll go to Senator Boquist's questions.
Hi, this is Kate Toswell, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. So if I could just at a sort of at the broad level, as Kyle was describing, there is a provision in the bill, in the American Rescue Plan, that was actually added in the second chamber. It wasn't in the House version. It was added when the bill went to the Senate, and it does say that states cannot accept these funds and use them to provide a tax cut. And it's pretty expansive language. It talks about any credit, deduction. I can actually find it. By providing a reduction in a rate, a rebate, a deduction, a credit, or otherwise, that during the covered period. And the covered period is defined as the time frame that begins between March 3rd, 2021, and ends on the last day of the fiscal year in which the state government either receives the money, have expended, or returned the funds to the Treasury. What I will say is, this came in at the last minute, and it is definitely a subject of contention. There's already litigation and letters to the Treasury that have been prepared by state governments. So one thing that we're clear on is that there's going to be some more guidance in the form of Treasury regulations, and there's also litigation that's already in the form of asking for a preliminary injunction that's already been filed by the state of Ohio. This would affect state tax cuts, though. So I'm not sure what the question is specifically about unemployment.
The question is that we are, obviously we're connected to the federal non-taxation of unemployment benefits up to a little over $10,000. And if we stay connected, is that going to count against us as if we were lowering taxes, even though it's not an income tax? It is an income tax the way, obviously we tax unemployment benefits. So is that going to, do we need to, in order to be sure of not losing federal funds, would we have to disconnect and tax those benefits?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, as an initial impression, my understanding is that this addresses state tax cuts at the state level. And there are many states that are connected in various ways to federal tax law. And just in reading the provision in the ARPA, that is not my understanding of what the concern was or what the intent was. The idea was if states or actually local governments as well, but this particular provision is aimed at the states and territories, if the state accepts these funds, they can't then use them to enact their own tax cuts. So I don't think this is something, as a matter of first impression, obviously there's this ongoing litigation, but it doesn't look as if this is something that would be about whether a state is connected to federal law. I mean, it seems like that would defeat the purpose. The idea is that state legislatures would be deterred or prevented from passing their own tax cuts. And that's actually part of the reason why it's being challenged, because it's not clear that constitutionally Congress can do that, can direct how a state legislature is going to act. So as an initial impression and as a short answer, I don't think that is a provision that would, remaining connected, would trigger this provision.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Chris and Kyle, I don't think you have an answer right now, but it would be helpful for you in the same topic arena, unemployment insurance at the federal level, to help us at a later point, sooner, not later, very near future, in fact, understand the preliminary revenue impact of the unemployment insurance income exemption as it relates to the revenue forecast. And Chris and I have had a little bit of discussion on this so that we can determine where in 2021-22 this $200 to $250 million preliminary revenue impact falls, and how much of that was calculated or what was calculated into the revenue forecast in regards to the state economist, meaning how much of it is in fact already in estimated tax payments. I think Chris understands the question.
Yeah, Senator Boquist. And yeah, we'll be, this is an evolving issue that we are staying on top of, to your point of urgency. A couple points I can say. In the March forecast, this was not included in the March forecast. The exemption was not, at least as far as I'm aware. I mean, we'll follow up with OEA, and we'll be working with them to figure out what should be incorporated into their May forecast with respect to this provision.
As a follow-up, ma'am, it may not be in the forecast, but the question is where is the revenue in terms of withholdings is the second half of that question. So thank you.
Yeah, the withholding that is occurring right now is related to unemployment payments that are being made currently. This exemption is related to unemployment payments that were made in 2020. So both pieces are a key piece.
Is that it, Senator Boquist?
I'm trying to get the thing unhanded here, so yeah, okay. It doesn't want to turn off.
Thank you. Well, it just loves hearing from you. That's why. Okay. Other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you for that good, concise presentation, Kyle. And I'm sure we will be talking about this more as we move on. So I will close the informational meeting on the American Rescue Plan Act and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 726.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 726 would create a task force to study and analyze local government assessment and taxation services. The bill would require the task force to prepare recommendations for the legislature to consider by an interim revenue committee with a due date of September 15th, 2022.
Okay, and this is basically a placeholder to see if we can solve a problem that the counties have, which we are about to hear from. So we will start out with a panel of Eric Kankler, Jim Colon, and Scott Langton in that order. And so we'll start with Eric Kankler.
Chair Burdick, can you hear me?
We can.
Excellent. Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kankler, here representing county assessors and tax collectors. In support of Senate Bill 726, which would establish a task force on increasing and stabilizing funding for local administration of Oregon's property tax system. Mostly, I'm here to introduce Jim Colon, Curry County Assessor, and Scott Langton, the Deschutes County Assessor, and also co-chair of the Assessor's Legislative Committee, and to answer any questions about our intentions and possible paths forward on the issue. Jim's going to offer some context on the services that assessors and tax collectors provide, and discuss some of the public benefits of a fully funded assessment and tax collection system. And Scott is going to offer some context on how A&T services, as we call them, are funded, how the state's portion has continued to decline relative to the overall need for service, and the impact both on county general funds and levels of service to taxing districts and taxpayers. Before I hand this off to Jim and Scott, I just want to say that assessors and tax collectors spent a fair amount of time in the interim discussing with county administrators, with AOC, with DOR, get a better understanding of the level of funding issue that we're facing, evaluating possible funding solutions and considering different paths forward. We had hoped to come into session having had a more robust conversation, not just amongst those that I mentioned who have a direct role either in administering or overseeing the administration of the property tax system, but also with the taxing districts, with the stakeholders and other interests to work through potential solutions together in advance of the session. Unfortunately, the challenges of 2020 impacted our pace, and we're not at that point yet. So at this point, I clearly need to acknowledge the need for additional discussion, and I just want to relay options in terms of time frame. Chair Burdick mentioned that this bill is a placeholder. I think that would be excellent if we could get to the point where that is the case this session. As drafted, it is an interim task force bill, and it does put us in a position of requiring a report back to the legislature by, I think it's September of 2022 in advance of the 2023 legislative session. We can certainly and would like to find a way to pursue a more aggressive timeline, either moving that up to the 2022 legislative session, or even if possible, attempting to meet during the course of the current session and see what we might be able to come up with. So I'm going to leave it at that. And as to the specific language of Senate Bill 726, if we do end up proceeding with a task force, we're certainly open to discussing the details of that task force, making sure that it has the right makeup, the right charge, the right time frame, that everybody that needs to be included is included. So I'll leave it at that, and I will hand it over to Jim and then Scott, and we'd be happy to stick around and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim Colon is next.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee. I am Jim Colon and have served as a Curry County assessor since 1989. As such, that makes me the longest serving assessor in the state of Oregon. Curry County is the southwesternmost county in the state of Oregon, and we have a population of approximately 23,000 citizens. And coincidentally, in assessment and taxation, we have approximately 23,000 accounts. This makes Curry County the 26th largest county in the state of Oregon. As perspective, in Curry, we assess and collect approximately $29 million in property taxes for the taxing districts, as compared to Oregon's largest county, Multnomah County, which collects approximately $1.7 million in property taxes, or the smallest county in the state, Wheeler, which collects approximately $2.5 million for their districts. In A&T, our primary goal is to assess and collect the property tax levied by all of the school, city, county, and other special districts in the state. The work we do provides the primary funding source for these and other districts, such as rural fire protection districts, ports, cemeteries, and library districts. And we also collect fees that support the Oregon Wildland Fire Protection Fund. A byproduct of administering the property tax system is that we have created a huge database of assessor's maps, parcel shape files, and ownerships, sales, values, and property improvement inventories. This ownership map and additional data has become the base layer for the GIS maps in the state of Oregon. GIS has become a vital source of information for emergency responders, such as state and local firefighters, police, ambulance, and is also the base for statewide land use planning. GIS is also widely used by public and other small businesses such as realtors, mortgage companies, surveyors, and utilities. Assessors also work with enterprise zones and other exemptions of charitable institutions, as well as partial exemptions such as farm and forest land special assessments. Some of these exemptions are very complex and difficult to administer, but assessors administer these special tax programs to ensure that the benefits sought by the state and local governments are realized by the intended recipients. For A&T, our mission is unity in purpose and equity in assessment. This mission is a code of honor for assessors. We look to provide fair, equitable assessments. In A&T, our customers are not only the special districts who provide vital services, our customers are also property owners and citizens of Oregon. We strive to ensure that property owners pay only their fair share of the property tax burden. To do this, assessors' offices are continuously training and working to provide accurate and up-to-date market and assessed values. Assessors are exchanging ideas on best practices, collaborating on projects, and scraping all available resources together to get this work done. Even so, as you are aware, assessors are frequently called upon to defend values in tax court. As assessors, we know that the more efficiently we can accomplish this work for our customers, the greater benefit our districts can provide to the citizens of this state. As recently as the year 2006, Curry County had 13.4 FTEs in its A&T program. Then the Great Recession and the virtual curtailment of O&C and forestry seats dropped our resources down to 7.5 FTEs. We dropped from a six-year reappraisal cycle to a pace of 18 years to completely reappraise all the properties in the county. Recently, we were able to convince the Curry County Budget Committee to grant us one additional FTE of appraisal resource. We hired someone new to appraisal and are still training them, but we've had with us for a little over a year, and our production has increased. This last 12 months with the additional appraiser, our production has increased and dropped us from an 18-year pace to a pace of a little less than 11.5 years to completely reappraise the properties in the county. As people get trained up, we believe that by this time next year, we'll be on a production pace for a little less than a 10-year cycle on maintenance reappraisal, if we can maintain our current level of funding. Ideally, we want to get back to a six-year reappraisal cycle, because if we find omitted properties, we can go back 5 years and the current year to collect the back taxes that otherwise would have been lost to the taxing districts. A big part of our justification for additional appraisal resource was the unpermitted omitted new construction values that we were finding in the county. As a reminder, our two main tools for discovering new construction are building permits and maintenance reappraisal. We have found that not everyone gets building permits. Some things like paving small decks or small sheds don't require building permits. However, we are seeing garages, shops, complete remodels or even new houses being built without building permits. I did submit a PowerPoint slide. I'm not sure if we got it there. Do you have it? There it is. That picture is showing two pictures of the same property. The photo on the right is a picture of a garage with some upstairs storage space. And these property owners got a permit for that garage structure. Then some years later, we returned to the property and found the structure on the right, which is the same property, but we did, that property owner did not get any building permits for the extra property on the right. So this is what we're finding out there, it as we're doing our maintenance reappraisal. From 2012 through 2019, we picked up a total of $30.2 million in unpermitted new construction values. This is construction for which building permits were not taken. That averaged $3.8 million per year. In 2020, with the additional appraisal resource, we found and put over $6 million in unpermitted new construction values on the roll. So far this year, between November 1st and today, we've already picked up $4.7 million. Since 2012, the amounts to value generating are the amounts we've collected are generating approximately another $300,000 per year in property taxes for county taxing districts, over half of which in Curry County would go to schools. Under our current property tax system, Measure 50, the taxable values of these properties continue to grow by 3% per year. Overall, the extra resource is working out very well, and we are grateful for the resource that we is allowing us to do a better job ensuring equity in property owners paying only their fair share. Thank you for allowing me this time today. I know you have many concerns to consider for Oregon. Thank you.
And thank you. And we'll take Mr. Langton and then open this panel for questions. So Mr. Langton, are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me, Chair?
We can. So go ahead. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist, members of the community. My name is Scott Langton, and I'm the Deschutes County Assessor and co-chair of the Assessor's Legislative Committee. I'm going to talk a little bit about funding and where county A&T funding comes from. The primary source is a county general fund, and the secondary source is a Department of Revenue overseeing county assessment function funding assistance program, or a CAFA grant. That CAFA grant's made up of recording fees and a portion of delinquent property tax interest that is collected locally and then sent to the state, equalized back out to the 36 counties. And a very small amount of revenue comes from charges for things such as copies of maps and to offset some expenses. But the lion's share is County General Fund and that CAFA grant. There are currently no other funding mechanisms for A&T. I did submit a graph. Do you have that graph that we can put up? Not sure if that's there or not.
We're not seeing it.
It's there. We'll get it up in a second.
Okay. And this graph is a 20-year history of this CAFA program and where it started, the last big change that we saw in 2000. At that point, they changed an increased number and types of recording fees, the recordings that SPU was applied to. At that point, it represented about a third of county A&T funding. And that's been on a steady decline. Now it represents about half of what it was originally at in 2000. And that will continue to decline over time as the amount in that CAFA with the delinquent interest and recording fees has stayed relatively constant at plus or minus $20 million annually, where we have seen expenses due to both just inflation and also just increased workloads over the last 20 years, where you can see that that gap is further widening, which is creating the need for the county general fund to pick up a larger portion of the assessment and taxation funding on an annual basis. Additionally, in the last 20 years, the landscape has changed pretty dramatically depending on counties. You've got ONC counties such as Jim Colon just from Curry County just brought up, where the permanent funding rate for their county general fund didn't include ONC monies that were there that are now no longer there or at a reduced level. You have high growth counties such as Deschutes County, where we've seen growth in assessed values in excess of 3% because of that additional new growth we've experienced. You also have lower slow growth counties, which are many of the smaller counties, and they see a different landscape. But it's still one size fits all on this funding. And the A&T funding falls under the budget authority of county commissioners. It'll vary county by county, but typically a county receives less than 20% of the total taxes imposed for county services, where they're funding over in excess of now 80% of the cost to administer. And this gap, as I said, will widen each and every year under the current scenario. So, and that's a real quick overview of what I had. We appreciate your willingness to consider Senate Bill 726. And thank you for your time. And if you guys have any questions, we'd be happy to stay on and answer those.
Thank you. Are there questions of this panel? I see no questions, so we will move to our next witness, Tyler Jansen.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Tyler Jansen. I'm here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, where I handle governance and revenue issues. You've just heard from a couple of county assessors who put it very, very well. I'm here simply to say that AOC supports taking a much closer look at county assessment and taxation funding overall. As has been pointed out, it's declined in recent years, and I can think of three good reasons why we need to make sure that we are have the resources we need for this important function. Number one, we need to collect accurately, and you've seen some photos of the difficulties of doing that when you've had a reduction in these services. Number two, these services are going to help with emergency response through that coordination with GIS. And number three, it's really important that we take a really robust look at A&T statewide so that we can more confidently understand the intersection between the collection side and the relief side. I know that in lieu of all the recent natural disasters that we faced across the state, there are many, you know, who are interested in looking at some sort of relief regarding delinquent interest or reduction of fees. And it's very, very important that we fully understand how that intersection rests with the CAFA funding that we get. So again, AOC is happy to be here in support of Senate Bill 726, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? I see no questions, so we will move to Mark Garst from the League of Oregon Cities.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. The cities certainly appreciate the good work that the assessors do, and we're very much in favor of having the conversation along the lines of what's laid out in Senate Bill 726. You know, we looked at this issue in 2019 most recently, and at that time, staffing levels for assessors' offices were down about 11% from 2007 to 2018. And when you looked at those counties like Jim's, with less than a $2 permanent rate, the decrease was about 20% of staffing had been lost. This is a symptom of a broken property tax system. Measures 5 and 50 don't really give the flexibility to keep up with costs, and it just leads to these kinds of outcomes. Why is it so important? A lot of this value, the kind of things that Jim was talking about, you're just not going to find it unless you have boots on the ground, and that means staffing. And, you know, just in the case of a permit, it could be that someone pulled a permit, but the permit only shows that they changed one electrical outlet. Unless you send an assessor out there, you don't know whether that was a whole addition that they added to the house or whether it was just a really small addition of an outlet somewhere. So it's really important that the assessors be able to get out and actually physically look at these properties. It's also good for businesses just to know that the assessor comes out every once in a while, right? We have a voluntary compliance system with our property tax system in Oregon. You file your personal property returns, you file your industrial property returns. If you never see somebody from the assessor's staff or from the Department of Revenue come out to your facility, it just doesn't really encourage voluntary compliance. So we think it's important for that reason as well. Also, you know, our property tax system is interesting because it only has a one-way valve, right? If you think you're value is too high, you might appeal that value, but nobody's appealing if the value is too low. And so that work really just falls on the assessor. Measure 50 kind of decreases the amount of value that real market value has, right? You're taxed on generally your maximum assessed value. And but just the same, it's important when we set that initial maximum assessed value, it's important to make sure that we capture that 3% growth that we might have in the maximum assessed value. So real market values do matter, and the assessor is the only one who can, who's there to look out to make sure that that correct number is on the roll. Cities support Senate Bill 726. We would support it certainly as a group to get together and have these conversations. We had supported House Bill 2014, which was in the 2019 session. This was a Department of Revenue governor's concept that would have taken a small portion of the early payment discount on business property, and it would have pushed that money to the counties and to the Department of Revenue to kind of address this issue. That bill didn't really go anywhere, but we were certainly supportive of that conversation. Where we will have some issues is if the solution that we would come up with would be something where you would take money from the taxing districts to give it to the county to pay for these expenses. We certainly know that the counties are in tough shape. We're in that same shape, right? We're under the same property tax system that they are. And just like the counties, the, you know, cities' costs have generally increased faster than the revenues are allowed to increase under Measures 5 and 50. You know, there's a conversation about property tax reform happening someday. Hopefully we get there. And this certainly needs to be a big part of that conversation. If we go back to a system based off of real market value, appeals are going to go way up. Right now, many people do not appeal because the real market value is so much higher than their maximum assessed value that even if they got a significant reduction in their RMV, it wouldn't affect their taxes. But that will change if we go to a real market value system, and we will need to be fully funding our assessor's offices when we get to that point. So again, very supportive of this concept. If there was anything that we might tweak, we might look at the representation of the members on that task force. Right now, it's weighted a little heavily towards counties, and we would just kind of want equal representatives among the various taxing districts. But aside from that, just very supportive, and we really welcome this conversation. And again, we really appreciate all the work that the assessors do. Not an easy job.
Okay, thank you. And I probably overstated it. It seemed overly ambitious to call it a placeholder bill. It would obviously be great to get something moving toward a solution on this, but we will take the bill itself seriously. Okay, next we have Saiji Shiratori.
Yes, Chair Burdick, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, Chair Burdick, committee members, Sage Shiratori, Oregon Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. Previous witnesses did a great job, so I'm not going to repeat what they had to say. We have no position on the bill as a department, but a couple of things just to tie everything together. I did want to underscore, in addition to what Jim Colon and Scott Langton were saying about the gap in the CAFA distributions and the overall expenditures that's arisen over the past couple of decades, much of the time, the larger, more populous counties have less trouble covering that gap. Whereas often the less populous rural counties do encounter more problems covering that gap. I did want to underscore that. The final thing I'll do here is just to talk about ideas that have been tried before. Now, Mark Garst rightly mentioned the legislation in 2019 that was unsuccessful that would have put some of the burden on business by reducing that early payment discount. Other ideas that have been suggested would put some burden on, let's say, the construction and real estate industry by raising recording fees. Other ideas, like Mark mentioned, might be shifting the balance of the burden among the tax different types of taxing difference, counties versus cities, special districts, and schools. So what all of those ideas have in common is that somebody's got to pay. And so the only kind of academic critical thinking type of comment I might say about this legislation that would create a task force is that it may be very helpful to make sure, as Mark suggested, to get the membership right. There's not, it may come back with recommendations that are not viable if there's not really specific representation of, let's just be frank, the real estate industry, the construction industry, business writ large, so that all stakeholders are have a voice in who's going to pay. So that's all I've got to say, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, I see no questions. We have Marjorie Taylor and Ben Gilley from the Department of Revenue if there are questions of them, but I don't see any. So that concludes this hearing. And Chris, I believe that concludes our business. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, committee. Thank you, witnesses. And we are adjourned.